Hare Krishna, and welcome to Krishna in Vrindavan for Kartik. Today we're going to be doing episode 21, which is worshipping Govardhan Hill and Krishna lifting Govardhan Hill. So, Krishna, 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 hey, Krishna, 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 hey. Krishna, 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 Rakshamam. Krishna, 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 Pahimam. Rama, Raghava, Rama, Raghava, Rama, Raghava, Rakshamam. Krishna, Keshava, Krishna, Keshava, Krishna, Keshava, Pahimam. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Jai. So we are reading from Canto 10, Chapter 24 and 25. Let's see how far we get with 25. This pastime, actually, we're doing two classes on this pastime because it actually covers three full chapters in the Bhagavatam. So there's a lot. This is a very lengthy pastime. So today we'll do worshipping Govardhan Hill, and we might get to Krishna lifting Govardhan Hill. Otherwise, we'll complete that tomorrow. And then tomorrow we'll also do prayers by Indra and the Sarabi cow. So it's very sweet, all this. So this yesterday we talked about the wives of the Brahmins being blessed by Krishna. And there are a lot of parallels between that pastime and this pastime of punishing Lord Indra. So the parallel is that Krishna is establishing the standard of pure devotional service by demonstrating the futility, one, of ritualistic sacrifices. So that he displayed by with the wives of the Brahmins, showing that this ritualistic sacrifices that the Brahmins were performing were pretty much useless because they weren't leading one to love for Krishna. Whereas the wives who hadn't undergone all these, Vedic studies and austerities and sacrifices, but they had love for Krishna. So what is the use of all these ritualistic ceremonies if without doing the people who didn't do them are more exalted than the people who are doing them? And now in the pastime of Govardhan Puja, he's going to point out the futility of demigod worship. So his own father is planning to do some demigod worship. And in both of these pastimes too, Krishna is pointing out the importance of humility, because with the Brahmin, he defeats the pride of the Brahmins who are performing sacrifices, and he's also going to defeat the pride of Indra. So two very important lessons that we learn from both of these pastimes is that the superiority of bhakti, of loving devotion to Krishna, and the importance of humility. And the opposite of that, doing Vedic rituals and being proud about it are absolute no-nos. So, all right. So this starts off with Nandamaraj is starting to prepare a sacrifice for Indra. And Krishna goes and of course, Krishna knows everything that's going on, but he pretends not to, and he approaches his father just like an innocent child, asking him, "What's going on here? What are you doing? What's all the fuss about? Everybody's so busy preparing things." And so he asks, "What are you trying to accomplish here? For whose satisfaction is it intended? And by what means is it going to be executed?" And of course, Nandamaraj at first is kind of like, too busy to bother with Krishna's questions. He's just a small child asking a lot of questions, and parents are doing something very important. It's like, "Stop asking questions. I'm busy here. Can't you see I'm busy here?" So then Krishna gets on his case and he says, "Look, I really want to know. And saintly people don't keep secrets. A saintly person, their behavior should be transparent. They're not hiding anything." So he's saying, "You shouldn't hide anything. And especially because I'm a family member." Saintly people don't even hide anything from their enemies, what to speak of friends and family. They consider their friends and family to be as good as their own selves. So then Krishna says, he reveals an important point here about doing anything in spiritual life or even in material life, whatever we do. He says, I'm reading text 6. When people in this world perform activities, sometimes they understand what they're doing and sometimes they don't. Those who know what they're doing achieve success in their work, whereas ignorant people do not. So he's making the point that when we, whatever we do in life, we should really understand what we're really doing and why. And we should be doing things purposefully, not just whimsically or willy-nilly or just blindly following tradition or blindly following authority or just being like sheep and going with the flow in life. We should always stop and question, you know, what am I doing? Is this achieving any real ultimate purpose? Especially my real self-interest as a soul, is it fulfilling my spiritual needs or at least some essential need in my life? So Krishna is very emphatic about this. And as new devotees also, it's important to find out what we're doing. So even when you come to Krishna consciousness, there's many rituals that we do. And, you know, even chanting, or, you know, why do we chant Hare Krishna? Why do we wake up early? Why do we sing this song at this time? Why do we dress like this? Why do we eat? So it's good to just question, you know, just question everything, find out the reasons, because there actually are reasons, there are explanations for everything. And if there aren't, then, you know, why are we doing it if we don't know why we're doing it? So it's good to find all these things out and be informed, because after a while, you know, somebody will ask us, so why do devotees do that? And then you've been practicing Krishna consciousness for 10, 15 years, and you're just like, oh, gee whiz, I never thought about that. I'm not sure why they do it. I just saw everyone doing it. So it's kind of dumb, you know? It's like we have to know why we're doing things. And that's what Krishna's saying. And by knowing what we're doing and why we're doing it, when we know what we're doing and why we're doing it, then we achieve success. If we're just doing them in ignorance, like blind following, then we're not going to get the same result. It's always good to act with full knowledge. So yeah, that's why association of devotees is so important, because then we can actually ask questions. If we're practicing our spiritual practices in a vacuum, then how are we ever going to know? So then Nandamaraj explains. He's saying that, well, after all, you know, we're Vaishyas, and particularly we protect cows. So the cows, they need to graze on grass. And so we need the whole Vrindavan to be covered with grass. And therefore, grass requires a lot of rain. If it wasn't for the rain, we wouldn't have grass. And without the grass, we were going to feed the cows. And we're going to be, you know, our whole occupation will be done for. So he said, we really need Indra to send the rain. And yeah. And so Krishna, he's not convinced. And he's going to speak what's technically called karma mimamsa philosophy, which Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says is basically atheism with a belief in reincarnation. So you don't believe, according to karma mimamsa, there's no God, but there is eternal life. So the soul lives forever. That means we're going to leave this body. We're going to take birth again. So we need to think about how to elevate ourselves to have a better next life. But that elevation doesn't depend on the Lord or in demigods. It just depends on karma. So it's our work alone, our activities that determine our destiny. And if we do pious deeds, we go to heaven. If we do impious activities, we go to the lower planets. And that's it. And according to our karma, we take birth in a certain family, we get a certain type of body, we have a certain conditioned nature, which determines the modes of nature that influence us. And so we're pushed by the modes to do certain activities, and then those activities produce future karma. And God or demigods have nothing to do with it. That's karma mimamsa. It's all, the karma is supreme, basically. And therefore, karma means work or activities. So karma mimamsa means that you just focus on doing your duties. But that's what Krishna is saying. He's saying you don't need to worship Indra. Just go on, you know, protecting the cows and doing your duties as a Vaishya. And Indra is going to be obliged to provide rain. After all, you know, the rain is falling on the mountains. It's falling on the oceans. And the fish and shark in the sea are not worshiping Indra, but the rain is anyways falling. So we don't have to worship Indra either. That's his whole philosophy. Of course, we could refute all these philosophical points because they're all totally bogus. But you can see how Krishna is so insistent on establishing the highest truth, the higher purpose, that he's willing to even, in the beginning of the Srimad Bhagavatam, it kicks out cheating religion, right? Dharma projitikaitavo, completely rejecting all religious activities which are materially motivated. This Bhagavatam propounds the highest truth. So the Srimad Bhagavatam claims to kick out cheating religion. But now we have Krishna in the Bhagavatam speaking cheating religion, preaching cheating religion. Why? Because it's just a pathway to establishing the real religion, which is exclusive devotion to him. So Krishna will basically do anything to achieve the higher purpose of establishing loving devotional service to him. Arta?
How would you refute Karma Mimamsa philosophy?
How would I refute it? Mm-hmm. Well, because
you don't need to worship the demigods, the rains will come by your deeds.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that he's saying that the demigods, they can't, they have to, if you do some good deeds, they have to bless you. But if you don't do those good deeds, they can't bless you. So the demigods are controlled by karma. In other words, they have to follow the laws of karma. But the refutation is that who made these laws? Who made the laws of karma? Krishna made the laws of karma. And the lawmaker is above the laws. So, and the devotees are above the laws of karma. So for pure devotees, what happens to them is not due to their karma, but it's due to the loving reciprocation of the Lord. Yeah. And then you could also say that, like in the Bhagavad Gita, there are the five factors of action. So one of those is the activity itself. But another one, actually the main one, is the super soul. So everything has to be sanctioned by the super soul, who is the overseer and the permitter. So again, karma is not supreme. And And then another one is that not only is the Lord not controlled by karma, because he's the creator of the karma, but he burns up the karma of those who perform devotional service. That's there's a verse from the Brahma Samhita, Karmani Nir Dahati. What is it? Karmani Nir Dahati, something, Bhakti Bhajam. Yeah, it means that he frees those who perform, who worship him with devotion. He frees them from all the reactions of their karma. So, yeah, Krishna is absolutely like free and independent of all these laws, and he can act, he can also free the devotees from these laws. Yeah,
that's another one.
Yeah.
If you're a devotee who needed rains, would you do a specific sacrifice, even Harinam Sankirtan sacrifice? Or would you just say whether the rains come or not?
I mean, you could say, like, I think we just lost him. Anyways, I think I got the gist of the question, that if we need rain, would we pray for rain, perform Harinam for rain, or would we just serve Krishna, and if Krishna wants, and wait and see if he thinks we deserve rain. Well, if we're in the middle of a drought and our existence is threatened, then we could approach Krishna. You know, like the Brajavasis are always approaching Krishna whenever they're in any kind of crisis. So we could approach Krishna with, you know, Krishna, the situation here is pretty bleak for us. We're, you know, wondering if we're going to have food because the growing season is curtailed by the drought. So if you so desire, please reward our Sankirtan Yajna with rain, with abundant rainfall, like that, if you so desire. Yeah, Ali?
If you so desire mood, but isn't full surrender whatever you want? So how do we not try to forego that if you so desired, instead of just trying to be like whatever you want, Krishna, you want it?
Yes. It just depends on our level, I guess. Like Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he prays like that, right? We're doing the Sharanagati Saturdays. We're reading singing the songs of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And he says that if you like, you can kill me. If you like, you can protect me. It's just totally up to you, because after all, I'm yours. I don't have a separate identity. I don't have a life separate from what you want to do with me. So if you're on that level, then okay. But otherwise, if you're thinking that you need to maintain your life in this world for some reason, then you could ask for rain. sorry, Ali, go ahead.
I mean, I guess I'm kind of done. I mean, isn't that what, shouldn't we be practicing that? Shouldn't we just be living like that anyway?
Yeah, that's the best way to live. I mean, because then you don't have to worry about anything, because you just surrender to Krishna, and whatever happens is, you know, it's for the best, because that's what, because Krishna always does the best thing.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Thanks.
Evan?
Yeah, I was also just thinking that Bhaktivinoda Thakur also petitions Krishna in that same song, like, please... give me, you know, even if you do protect me or kill me, please at least give me the body of a worm in a devotee's home or something. So
yeah,
he's still petitioning Krishna for something.
Yeah.
And so it's not like, I mean, and also the idea of Krishna sometimes does things so that we take shelter of him.
Yeah.
So I mean, they're both full surrender in my opinion.
Yeah. Yep. Good. Hannah?
I was going to say that everyone has desires. Like, whether you say it out loud or not, Krishna knows the desire that's within your heart. There's been times I desire things and I don't even say it out loud or even think of it for more than 5 minutes, and it just comes to me. So you're never going to be desireless. I think that if you're going to have a desire, like, contemplate your why, and if you're going to bring your desire to anyone, it's best to bring it to Krishna. Or
yeah,
so that's all I wanted to say.
Yeah. I mean, Krishna knows what we want, and I mean, also we're going to talk about this later, that it's one thing that we can say something with our words, but the real desire, you know, maybe there's a desire in our hearts, but with our words, we're thinking, what's the right thing to ask Krishna? So we enunciate something which we think is the right way to pray to Krishna, but Krishna sees that in our heart, there's something a little different. No, it's not that Krishna doesn't know. So, yeah. Max?
I think Evan had his hand up before me.
He's asked a question already.
Okay. So my question was, like, how do we know when Krishna is speaking through someone to give us a message, so to say, and when it's kind of completely bogus?
Well, it should, whatever somebody says should be, if a devotee says something, it should be aligned with Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. And then if you're still not, if you're not sure, you can ask a senior devotee what they think. All right, there's a lot of questions. We have a lot to cover here in this pastime too. Hannah, you have something else?
Oh yeah, one last thing. In regards to the question you just got, I don't know who asked it, but I was also told by a guru once that you can tell if something is true by the effect that it has on your heart. So, you know, sometimes you're not going to hear about anxiety, or you're not going to hear about, you know, mental illness in the Bhagavatam. So if someone gives you some advice that's like veered off, you can tell if it's true or not by the effect that it has on your heart. If it helps you to feel inspired and like you're going to be okay, then that's probably some good advice. And if you don't feel encouraged and you feel like disturbed, then you can then discover that feeling. So yeah.
Yeah, good. I was thinking that too, that, you know, if the advice that we get is, it's a, if it's inspiring, if we can feel that it, if it makes us want to chant, you know, if it makes us want to engage in the processes of devotional service more enthusiastically, then it's probably good. All right. Okay. So Krishna is speaking all this karma mimamsa. And he basically, it's not that Nandamaraj becomes convinced by the karma mimamsa philosophy, but they just become convinced because they love Krishna. And that's it. But Krishna does get kind of heavy. He says here that in text 19, he says, if one thing is actually sustaining our life, but we take shelter of something else, how can we achieve any real benefit? We would be like an unfaithful woman who can never achieve any actual benefit by consorting with her paramour. So he's saying that you're acting just like a woman who's cheating on her husband because you're worshiping this Indra who can't actually do anything for us, and you're neglecting Govardhan Hill, who's doing everything for us, who's providing everything for us. So it's kind of like a strong, you know, he's speaking very strongly to his father. Although it's described that he's not, when Krishna's speaking like this to Nandamaraj, he's not being harsh or rude at all. He's speaking very sweetly, very respectfully, but he's presenting these, you know, cogent points. And it says, according to Jiva Goswami, the audacity that child Krishna displayed before his father and other elders should be understood as an exhibition of transcendental anger aroused when he saw his eternal devotees worshiping an insignificant demigod. So Krishna, when he saw his eternal associates who are Nityasiddha devotees, and any pure devotee is actually more exalted than a demigod, because the demigods, they have material motivations, as we're going to see. But pure devotees are completely pure, totally surrendered to Krishna. So their position is higher than the demigods. So when Krishna saw his pure devotees, his own father, you know, worshiping this demigod, he was like, no, this is so wrong. You know, this cannot happen. So he wanted to rectify the situation. And let me just, okay, so now Krishna is going to start acting like an expert manager, and he's going to take charge of organizing this festival for Govardhan Hill. He says, therefore may a sacrifice for the pleasure of the cows, the Brahmins, and Govardhan Hill begin. With all the paraphernalia collected for worshiping Indra, let this sacrifice be performed instead. And then he's saying, you know, cook all these different kinds of food, sweet rice and cakes and vegetable soups and fried things and milk products. And, you know, he gives all the, he lists all the preparations that should be made, and he gives the recipes, and he tells them, go and cook all these things. And the Brahmins should be prepared to chant the appropriate Vedic mantras and to invoke the sacrificial fires. And then afterwards, he says, these Brahmins should be all fed very sumptuously and rewarded with cows and other gifts. And Kavi Karnapur says that from the Ananda Vrindavan Champu, he says, Krishna told Nandamaraj to feed the Brahmins until they laugh. You know how sometimes, like, you eat so much prasad, like there's, you eat prasadam until you like kind of get silly and start like just laughing and being a little silly. So he said, feed the Brahmins till that point, till they just start laughing. So, and not only the Brahmins, so feed the Brahmins first, but then also give food to everyone, even fallen souls, such as the dogs and the dog eaters, and give grass to the cows and feed all the animals. So Krishna wanted to make sure that everybody was fed, regardless of their qualification, but everyone should eat to their full satisfaction. And he tells everybody you should get all dressed up, decorate yourself with sandalwood paste and ornaments, and let's go to Govardhan Hill. And bring all the cows, decorate the cows too, put garlands on them and those pretty decorative blankets, and you know, put jewel pearls on their horns and all these things. So they did that. Yeah, they were really happy. They were actually really excited to do this festival. They thought this was fun. You know, it's like nice to do something new like that.
Wait, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
We recently read in Nectar of Instruction that we shouldn't prepare some like sumptuous prasadam. But oftentimes I feel like that's not the case in ISKCON. And this verse also just described that they should feed sumptuous prasadam to the Brahmins.
Yeah.
So how can we reconcile those two statements?
I mean, what it says in the Nectar of Instruction is that you shouldn't go around looking for sumptuous prasadam, just being driven by the urge of the tongue and belly. But as far as the person who is going to eat shouldn't be going here and there looking for good, tasty food. But the person who's cooking and giving food to others should prepare very sumptuous food to give to the Brahmins and to give to the guests and to feed everybody. So, yeah, you see, it's not that you shouldn't personally desire it, but if you're cooking for other devotees, you should want to please the devotees by providing a large quantity of very nice prasadam.
Okay,
I see. And then they don't have to go around looking for it. They just go to the side porch and there it is.
Very well.
Hannah?
Oh, the side porch. How I miss the side porch. okay, so when we're cooking, because sometimes I get upset with myself when I'm cooking and I'm thinking of pleasing the persons that I'm feeding it to. I get upset for thinking that way. Am I supposed to be cooking for Krishna first, or is it okay to think that I'm cooking for the devotees? Like, you know, it's like, I don't know.
Well, Krishna's never alone. He's always with the devotees. And Krishna says that one who says he's my devotee is not my devotee, but one who says he's a devotee of my devotees is my real devotee. So if you're meditating on pleasing the devotees, then you're going to be all right.
Okay, thank you.
So yeah, it says that they made so much rice that the rice was literally like piled up to the sky, like a second mountain. This huge pile of white rice. It looked like a white cloud in the sky. And the dal and these vegetable soups that they made, it was like, they were like lakes. There was so much of it. And when they brought it there, let me see. But it was something that I wanted to read here.
Where'd they put it all, Prabhu? Just plopped it on the ground?
I don't know. It makes it sound like they had like a huge hole there that they dumped all into. I don't know how they
dug a well and filled it with dal.
I mean, they're offering it to the hill. So, I mean, the hill anyway is made out of earth. So if there's a little earth mixed in with the dal, I guess it's not a problem. Let's see what it says here. The cowherd community then did all that Madhusudana had suggested. They arranged for the Brahmins to recite the auspicious Vedic mantras, use the paraphernalia that had been intended for Indra's sacrifice. They presented offerings to Govardhan Hill and the Brahmins with reverential respect. They also gave grass to the cows. Then placing the cows, bulls, and cows in front of them, they circumambulated Govardhan Hill. So there's a nice point here that because, see, that they gave up their worship of the demigods and they just did what Krishna said. So some people might say that the Vrajvasis were just like very simple-minded. Just kind of ignorant, you know, they didn't care about Vedic injunctions. They didn't care about anything. They just gave up the tradition and the customs and the Vedic everything. And they just did what Krishna said. So some people can also say that about us, you know, like when we come to Krishna consciousness, it's just all about Krishna. We're chanting Hare Krishna, eating Krishna prasada and serving Krishna and, you know, Krishna this and Krishna that and everything Krishna. And they might criticize them, us that we're just like out of touch, you know, with the world, that we're living in a bubble and just kind of ignorant about world events and, you know, issues and concerns of the world. So it says here in the purport that this simple loving mentality of the Vrajvasis was not small-mindedness or ignorance, because they were devoted to the supreme absolute truth, which contains within himself all existence. So because everything is contained within Krishna, that if you just worship Krishna, then it's like everything is included in that. Like all the world issues and, you know, things that are going on, it's like you're not disconnected with that, because all that rests within Krishna. And because we're connected with Krishna, then we're connected with everything. It's not that we're out of touch. We're more in touch than anybody, because we actually understand the reality and the source of everything. And we're in touch with that. So yeah, Krishna is the cause of all causes and that which sustains the existence of all that exists. So that's how we can defend the devotees from people who think that we're just out of touch. We're just cloistered, living in a little spiritual bubble. All right, so then they spread out all these, like, tons and tons of food there to Govardhan Hill. They cooked literally everything that they had in their homes, and they took it there, bullet cart loads of it, and just spread it out there and offered it to Govardhan. And then Krishna, or Govardhan, well, the thing is that Govardhan is Krishna. Govardhan Hill is non-different from Krishna. And so when the offerings are there, then Govardhan, Krishna assumed a huge form. It says here in text 35, Krishna then assumed an unprecedented huge form to instill faith in the cowherd men, declaring, "I am Govardhan Mountain." And he ate the abundant offerings. So, because all the cowherd people, they just took Krishna's word for it. They just accepted Krishna's proposal with faith in Krishna. But they may have had a doubt. Oh, but, you know, are we going to have problems with Indra now? So Krishna, he exhibited this humongous form, not just to eat all the offerings, but to convince them that their decision to follow his advice was correct. And so it was kind of like a confirmation that you're doing the right thing. Just see, you know, this amazing form of the Lord is just exhibiting himself. And this form was separate from Krishna. So Krishna was standing there in his little cowherd boy form, little 7-year-old boy. And he's pointing to the big form saying, look, 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 this shows that, you know, the gods have accepted the offering, that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is here. And it also shows that Govardhan Hill is not just a hill, not just a bunch of stones and dirt all piled up, but Govardhan Hill is actually a personality. It's a divine personality. And they all offer obeisances. And Krishna also, he gets down on the ground and offers obeisances to this huge personality of Govardhan Hill, which is actually himself. So Krishna in his small cowherd boy form is offering obeisances to himself in his huge Govardhan Hill form. So yeah, so it says. He says, just see how this hill has appeared in person to bestow mercy upon us. And if you go to Govardhan Hill in Vrindavan, there are some parts of the hill there. There's like the tongue of Govardhan, there's the mouth, the face of Govardhan, and the feet of Govardhan. So the thing is that when Govardhan Hill manifested as a person, he had all these, you know, parts of the body that were, you know, manifested. And so those are still there. Like when Raghunath Das Goswami was excavating Radhakund, they were digging, and Radhakund is right there at the end of Govardhan Hill. So they were digging around. There was just like a little spring that was bubbling up out of the ground. And Lord Chaitanya said, this is Radhakund. You should excavate. You should dig a big thing and, you know, make ghats all the way around, like steps so that people can bathe. So he was digging and digging, got so many workers to come, and they were digging and digging to make this big, you know, like pool like it is now. And at one point they hit one of the men was with a pick, and he hit one stone and blood started coming out of it. So then he went and told Raghunatha Goswami what happened. And he said, all right, stop the work. No more work today, because we have to understand what happened. So that night, Raghunatha Das Goswami had a dream in which Govardhan, this personality of Govardhan, appeared to him and said that you cut my tongue today. And that's what this bleeding stone was. And then Raghunatha Das Goswami was like, oh no, you know, please forgive us. It was a mistake. What can we do now? And he said, you should go very carefully and get that stone from the earth and make a small shrine and put it in there. And that will be the Jiva Mandir. Jiva, J-I-H-V-A, means tongue. So that's there. If you go to Radhakund, there's a small shrine and a stone there. And that's the tongue of Govardhan that's worshipped there from the time of Raghunatha Das Goswami. So yeah, so all these parts of the body are there in Govardhan. All right. So then Krishna says, this Govardhan hill, assuming any form he wishes, will kill any residents of the forest who neglect him. Therefore, let us pay our obeisances to him for the safety of ourselves and the cows. So yeah, it was actually Krishna saying that form was actually Govardhan hill, that assumed this form that was kind of like a human form. Okay, so then that is chapter 24. Now we're going to go into chapter 25. So now here, Indra, he's watching all these things that are going on, because he was expecting on this day that there would be a big sacrifice for him. And it wasn't happening, so he was observing. Well, what are they doing then? If they're not worshiping me, what are they doing? And so they're saying, oh, they put aside my worship just to worship this hill, and on the advice of this little, you know, talkative child. So he got really angry with Nanda Maharaj, and he thought, how is it that they're worshiping this ordinary boy? So there's a word here in text 2, Sanskrit word, Isha Mana. So Isha means the controller, and Mana means your thinking. So in other words, it's your thinking. Lord Indra was thinking that he's the controller. So this was his problem. It says, imagining himself the supreme controller. And like Indra, sometimes we also think that we're the supreme controllers, and we have this sense of entitlement, you know, like, kind of like a me first mentality. And we make our plans based on the belief that everybody has to do what we want. And if things don't go our way, then we get angry and we want to, you know, maybe not kill people, but somehow, you know, get these people out of the way, people who block our plans or respond in ways that we don't like, to just like push them aside. So that's exactly what Indra's doing. And this is the Isha Mana tendency. Yeah, Hannah?
I'm just a little confused. I thought all of the demigods knew who Krishna was. So was like Indra under the influence of Maya? Or like, could he not recognize Krishna? I mean, he's blue, so...
Well, the thing is that the demigods, they're used to Krishna being, they're more connected with Lord Vishnu, so they always go to Lord Vishnu as their worship. They're not used to seeing, so now Krishna has appeared in like an ordinary little boy, so it doesn't align, you know, with their conception of God, basically. It's like, okay, think about, I mean, I don't know if it's true for you, but it's definitely true for me when I first became a devotee. I had this conception of God, like the Christian's conception of God, that he's the creator, he's the controller, he's this like great and awesome, you know, person up there in the sky who's controlling everything. And then when you become a devotee, you see like Krishna. He's just this little boy and he's stealing butter and dancing with gopis. And you're just like, there's like a disconnect, you know, between what you understand God to be and what Krishna is. It's like, it just doesn't square up. And I even remember saying that when I was a new devotee in London, I went to Keshava Bharati Maharaj and I was just like, I'm not sure about my conception of God, because although I appreciate theoretically that Krishna is God, but Krishna, the personality of Krishna, just doesn't fit with my conception of God. So when I think of God, it's not Krishna. Although one part of me understands that Krishna is God, but just when I think of God, it's not Krishna. It's still my old conception of God. And I would like to think of God as Krishna, but for a while my mind is just not going there. So then Maharaj was very compassionate as always, and he's just like, "Don't worry, just keep practicing Krishna consciousness, and it'll all fall into place." And it did. So yeah, so this is the situation of the demigods. Their idea of God is great, powerful, you know, worshipable personality. And then when they observe Krishna's pastimes on earth, where he's acting like just like an ordinary child, doing childish things and silly things and things that are not even very things that they might consider morally apprehensible or even ignorant, like eating food out of his left hand, or, you know, like going to a clean part of the house and passing stool and urine or something like that, you know, they're just like, "Oh my God, that can't be God. Who is it?" You know, so they just can't get their heads around it, basically. And so they have doubts. They doubt whether Krishna is God. And that's why Brahma previously, he tested Krishna he's like, "Let's see if this is actually God," because he's supposedly God, but he just doesn't look like it. So thought, "Let me see."
Oh, yeah.
Remember, he was testing
him. Yeah.
And then he got, like, in the end, he's like, "Okay, Krishna's God, I got it." And then he was very remorseful for his trying to challenge Krishna. So, okay. Yeah, so Indra's in this, and Indra now is just completely, because he's thinking he's the supreme controller, it's actually him that's in the mode of ignorance. And if you look, like, in the Bhagavad Gita, it talks about knowledge in the mode of ignorance. Is that you don't know, you basically like get everything backwards, right? Like you take a religion to be irreligion, you do the wrong thing, and yeah, the thing that you're supposed to do, you don't do, you think it's wrong, and the thing that you're supposed to do, you don't do, like that. So in this way, Indra's seeing everything exactly the opposite. He's seeing religion as irreligion and irreligion as religion. So he's thinking that he's the supreme controller, and that he should be worshipped, but actually Krishna is the supreme controller and Krishna should be worshipped. So let's see. Yeah, he's saying that, okay, where is it? He says, "Just see how these cowherd men living in the forest have become so greatly intoxicated by their prosperity. They have surrendered to an ordinary human being, Krishna, and thus they have offended the gods." So you see, like, actually they surrendered to the supreme personality of Godhead, and it's him who's offending God. And he's saying that these Vrajavasis are intoxicated by their prosperity, but actually Indra is the one who's intoxicated by his prosperity. Then they say, "They're taking shelter of Krishna is just like the foolish attempt of men who abandon transcendental knowledge of the self and instead try to cross over the great ocean of material existence in the false boats of fruitive ritualistic sacrifices." So isn't this ironic? You know, he's accusing the Vrajavasis of trying to cross the ocean of material existence in the false boats of fruitive ritualistic sacrifices. And he's the one who's all upset because they stopped his fruitive ritualistic sacrifice. And they're not even doing a fruitive ritualistic sacrifice. So he's just like, you know, he's just like totally seeing everything the opposite. Okay, he's seeing himself as God and Krishna as a mortal, but actually he is a mere mortal. Krishna is God. He is intoxicated by prosperity. Yeah. And he's the one who's being offensive. So due to his own ignorance and pride. And so now he's going to say some pretty rough things about Krishna. He says, these coward men have acted inimically towards me by taking shelter of this ordinary human being, Krishna, who thinks himself very wise, but who is simply a foolish, arrogant, over-talkative child. Yeah. So, of course, you know, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, whenever anybody blasphemes Krishna, he always finds a way to give a different spin, give a different interpretation on the Sanskrit words. So the word balisam, which means childish, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur translates to mean pure and innocent, like a child. And then stubdham, which means arrogant, he says means that the person has no one to, that Krishna has no one to offer obeisances to because he's the supreme. Agyam means like not knowledge, it means ignorant, but he says it means that that there's nothing for him to know. So instead of that he doesn't know anything, it's that there's nothing for him to know because he's omniscient. He knows everything. And then the Sanskrit pandita mananam, thinking himself wise, could mean honored by the wise. Martyam, mortal, could mean who appears in this world called Martyaloka out of affection for his devotees. And then vachalam, over-talkative, could mean a very expert orator. So like this, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur always gives an alternative meaning to the Sanskrit to glorify Krishna where somebody is blaspheming him. Yeah. And also Indra, he's thinking that the Vrajrasis' pride is due to their cows, because the Vrajrasis' wealth is the cows. And so he wants to destroy the cows. And because he's thinking, I'll destroy all the cows and then they'll have no more wealth. And then they'll become humble and then they'll worship me like they should. They become too puffed up thinking that they can act whimsically and neglect me. So, yeah, but actually it was Indra that was proud and it was Indra that was going to get smashed and the cows were going to be fine. So were the Vrajavasis. So then he calls the Samvartika cloud to come. And this Samvartika clouds are the clouds that they, at the time of universal devastation, they flood the whole universe. They obliterate the whole entire universe. And it's described that one raindrop from these clouds is like the size of the trunk of an elephant. It's like really long and it's like voluminous, a lot of water. And this rainfall is very deadly. You know, it submerges the entire universe. So in Ananda Vrindavan Champu, there's a description of this, the Samvartika clouds. It says that the clouds covered not just Vrindavan and not just this planet, but they extended from Swargaloka all the way down to Rasatala in the subterranean heavenly planets. And they totally blocked out the sun so that the whole world and all the planetary systems were dark. He says the universe was as black as the bottom of a pot that was used cooking on like an open fire. Just like totally black. And he uses the Sanskrit anda tamasa, which means blinding darkness. And the rain is described like a big river that breaks through the dam and is just like rushing, just like tons and tons of water suddenly rushing over a dam. That's how the rain was falling. And so the cows were standing there and they were moving so that their bodies were over top of the calves to try to protect them from the water. And the water was just pummeling them, you know, it was just, and also there was hailstones. So the cows were with their eyes closed and their tails were just going straight down and their backs were all swollen from being pelted by the hard hailstones. And they were just looking towards Krishna for shelter. And it says that the lightning, the flashing lightning bolts looked like the forked tongues of snakes. And then the clouds were roaring like angry beasts. So there's these, similes and metaphors to get the sense of the mood, like angry beasts, poisonous snakes, and just, yeah, it was really horrible, the situation. Was it raining only on Vrindavan? I think so. That's the way it's described. Although the clouds covered the whole universe, but the rain was just focusing on Vrindavan, like the Brahmastra, you know, that goes for its target. And in Garga Samhita, it says that, you know, in the Bhagavatam, it describes the structure of the universe. And so there are four elephants that are on the four directions and the extremities of the universe. And they balance the universe so that it stays in proper place and all the planets are in their orbits and stuff. So those elephants holding up the four directions of the universe were trembling even. And then soon it became so flooded there that the Vrajvasis couldn't distinguish the high ground from the low. So this reminds me like when there was a flood in Mayapur. I was there in one flood where the water was like up to the neck, you know? And so in Mayapur, those of you who have been there, the roads are all elevated because the land is kind of low. It's basically like a delta. It's all just very flat and low. And so it's flood prone. Even in the rainy season, it'll be all wet, even without flooding, but just from rainwater. But when during the flood time, so much, yeah, so the roads are up. They build up the roads by pouring in so much dirt and stones and bricks and things, and they build the roads up. So on both sides of the road, there's like a drop off that goes into lower land. So, but when the road is flooded over, you don't know where the raised road is and where the down part of the land is. So you might think you're walking down the road and, you know, maybe the water's only up to your waist. So you're walking, but then you can't see where the road is and where it's not. So then if you take a wrong step, you go down a drop off, like a 6-foot drop off. And then all of a sudden you're in water over your head. And that's how people were drowning, because they were trying to walk to the shop or walk to the temple, and they were just like not seeing where the road was and going off the edge of the road, and they couldn't swim and they drowned. So like that. So it was a very dangerous situation there. And so, and the rain was still falling. So it was water below, water above, water everywhere. And the Vrajvasis had nothing else that they could do except call out to Krishna. So that's what they do in verse 13. Krishna, Krishna, Mahabhaga. So it's always like this, you know, Krishna, Krishna, Mahabhaga, Krishna, Krishna, Mahayogin. Twannata Gokulam Prabho, Tratum Arhasi Devana, Kupitad Bhaktavatsala. It's a nice word, Bhaktavatsala. Oh, you who are very affectionate to your devotees. And Mahabhaga means, oh, fortunate one, please deliver the cows from the wrath of Indra. Oh Lord, you are so affectionate to your devotees. Please save us also. So it's sweet how they ask Krishna to save the cows before asking to save themselves. They wanted him to save the cows. And also they're thinking that Krishna, he loves the cows so much that he's more likely, of course he loves them too, but you know, somehow the cows just like bring out natural compassion. And next verse says, seeing the inhabitants of his Gokul rendered practically unconscious by the onslaught of hail and blasting wind, the Supreme Lord Hari understood that this was the work of angry Indra. There's an interesting purport here because it's saying, because it sounds like the Vrajvasis are very distressed by all this, but Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur explains that that they weren't actually feeling distress because what's happening here is that the storm is simply making them meditate more intensely on Krishna. And then by meditating on Krishna, they're feeling increased happiness rather than increased distress. And then he gives the analogy that for a hungry person, the pain of hunger increases the happiness he feels when he finally eats excellent food. And thus hunger can be said to enhance the pleasure of eating. So similarly, the residents of Vrindavan felt a type of distress at the activities of Indra and thus intensified their meditation on Krishna. When the Lord finally acted, the result was wonderful. So we all have the experience that when you're very hungry, then eating is more of a pleasure. So the more distress that the Vrajvasis were apparently feeling was actually making them more happy because it was making them meditate more intensely on Krishna. So this was all an arrangement by Krishna. And for increasing the loving exchanges. It's getting late. Well, I guess we could go till 6 o'clock. Is that okay? All right, so Krishna's thinking to himself, because we've stopped Indra's sacrifice, now he's caused this fierce, unseasonable rain with wind and hail. And so by my mystic power, I'm going to have to counteract this disturbance. He says, demigods like Indra are proud of their opulence, and out of foolishness, they falsely consider themselves the lord of the universe. I will now destroy such ignorance. So Krishna, yeah, now he's not, of course, Indra is the culprit in this scenario, but he's speaking generally now about the demigods. He says in the next verse, text 17, since the demigods are endowed with the mode of goodness, the false pride of considering oneself the Lord should certainly not affect them. When I break the false prestige of those bereft of goodness, my purpose is to bring them relief. So we see here that Krishna actually, he wants to do good for the demigods, so not just Indra, but he wants to teach a lesson to all the demigods that they should be in, they're supposed to be in the mode of goodness. And if a person's in the mode of goodness, then they don't become proud. Rather, they use their opulences and their power and influence in the spirit of Yukta Vairagya, in the service of the Lord. So an advanced devotee can use all kinds of material opulences in the service of the Lord without getting bewildered, without becoming proud, and like that. But if the modes of passionate ignorance somehow creep in, then also devotee doesn't need to worry, because Krishna protects them by taking the opulence away and breaking their false pride. What's Evan saying? Why is the idea of being God so attractive to the jivas? Not sure. Who's there? I'm doing the class right now. Can you wait 5 minutes?
Yeah.
Thanks. All right. I mean, the thing is, like, it's the nature of the soul is anandamaya vyasa, to enjoy. So we are meant to experience pleasure in our lives. And we see that, but Krishna is the supreme enjoyer. And so when we see Krishna enjoying himself, we think that that enjoyment is due to his being the supreme controller. So then we want to be the supreme controller. We want to be God. But actually, Krishna's enjoyment doesn't come from his being God. It doesn't come from his being the controller. It actually comes from his loving relationships with devotees. And Krishna, from Krishna's point of view, he's seeing that the devotees are experiencing more bliss than he is. And that's why he comes as Lord Chaitanya, so that he can experience the ecstasy of loving devotional service to Krishna in the mood of the gopis, who are the best devotees. So our wanting to be God is actually just another instance or another way that we're looking for happiness in the wrong places. Just like we think that, you know, sense gratification will make us happy, that sinful activities will make us happy, but they don't, they make us more miserable. So the same way we think being God would make us happy, having power, having influence, having, you know, status and all that is going to make us happy, but it doesn't. What makes us happy is having a loving relationship with Krishna. And if you look at the Brajvasis, they're actually very humble. Just see how they just do whatever Krishna says. And Krishna is also very humble. We're going to see that later. So that's what he's saying. Krishna is saying that when he breaks the false prestige of those bereft of goodness, his purpose is to bring them relief, because his false pride is actually a burden. It's actually a source of misery, that wanting to be God, or thinking that you're God, thinking that you're the supreme controller, it's actually a big, huge burden to carry around and gives us so much trouble. Whereas becoming humble is a relief. Humility is the happiest situation. Because when we're humble, it's like you don't have any expectations, so you don't have any disappointments. Everything's just fine, you know, and whatever comes easily, you're just totally grateful for, because you don't think you deserve anything. And you're happy to serve and help anybody, because you consider that they're superior to you. So it's just a very nice life, you know, it's very sweet and everything's easy. And people, you know, you associate with devotees who don't exploit you, and serve Krishna. All right, we're going to stop here. Going to leave you in suspense here on the edge of your seats because it is 6 o'clock and I promised Janaki I would go to Taco Tuesday. So Krishna in Vrindavan ki worshiping over that hill ki jai.
They're still doing kirtan.
The Prabhupada ki jai. Go Premanandi.
Haribol.
Thanks for coming, y'all.